Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for September 29th, 2022, in the ongoing series, year-long series of history of discoveries of my work. And the last 2 weeks, a couple weeks ago, I talked about the wing generator, which was developed in the early 2000s. So that's the time frame I'm working in right now in these shows. And then also, last week, I talked about the water filter business, and I did kind of a rough summary. Of course, not all of the nitty-gritty details, day-to-day working of the water filter company, but getting you up to speed of how I got to where I am today in the water filter company, JMCC Water Filters. Two big aspects of my life. And so, of course, the reason for developing these and being in these fields is, in general, a couple of decades ago, literally, I sat down and I looked at this and I said, you know, the big issues in the future are going to be energy and water. And I mean, you really didn't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that one out. But what I realized is that there were no solutions. And that is what triggered me. And I thought, you know, if these big companies were out there offering really good solutions for transportation and use of energy and economization of energy and production of energy, if these big corporations were out doing what they should be doing, then the world of energy and the world of water would be taken care of. But we have an EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, that's, like I say, a license to pollute. That's what they do. It's the Environmental Pollution Agency. They allow companies to pollute unrestricted year after year, and then don't fine them. And all of this ends up, and you have thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of companies out there, all with a legal right to pollute. Hey, what do you think is going to happen? Then you have agriculture, where they are using unbelievable toxic cancer-causing chemicals to grow food, and it's not really food, it's frankenfood. And all of these chemicals are going into the water table. So clearly, the big corporations, the government, etc., are just, they're not even in the ballpark of dealing with these issues. And then you talk to government scientists at the Department of Energy, for example, absolutely clueless. People that have been there for 20 years, considered top experts in their field, that don't know anything. They're just completely buffoons, occupying positions, doing the same thing now that they were doing 20, 25 years ago, expecting different results and pretending like they're really on top of things. So what I realize is that, you know, this machine is broken and there's nobody coming up with real solutions. So I said, I'm going to come up with real solutions and I'm going to define them and then I'm going to go after them and I'm going to build them and present them in a marketing program. So the energy and the water and then food with the grow towers, etc. I talked about that at the end of last week. But I want to put it into perspective that I set out to solve the world energy and water and food problems, and now those are available. Those are readily available, and anybody can have these. But the bigger issue is that these can be produced on a communal level, on a large-scale level, on the city level, on a state level, where you have big states like California, which are big energy consumers, they're big food consumers, they're big water consumers. And so all of this is going on, and so that's why it was very important for me to develop these. And of course, all of my experience with developing products and my experience in the telecommunications industry developing products. How do you develop a product? How do you make a product that's better than one that already exists? Even when there's a big company, when I was in the telecommunications industry, we had our big main competitor was IBM. And we were a little teeny company and we beat the pants off of them. We built better products by a long shot than what IBM could do with their major corporation, etc., because something about a big corporation, it's like an aircraft carrier, the biggest ship on the ocean ever built. You just can't turn it around easily, especially if it's moving. If it's just sitting there, you're going to have side thrusters that turn it. But if that thing is moving, there's only so much you can do as far as changing its direction because there's so much momentum. And that's like a big corporation. Once they get something developed and in marketing and all of those people moving, just think of how many things they have to sell to pay for all of that staff, all of those people and all of the infrastructure and everything else. And they can't change it. And if they do kind of they probably develop an okay product, but somebody else comes along, a little company that can move around quickly and change relatively rapidly and do things better, then you really have an advantage over the big company. But then you need a good sales force. You need good marketing, etc. But anyway, what I'm going to do here is go through the list. Now, I've gone through the books. I've gone through a couple products, like the water filter products last week, and then the wing generator a couple weeks ago. I talked about that in detail. And so now what I'm going to do is summarize the topics that I have developed out of thin air, basically, and that really replace what has been put there by NASA, Standard Astronomy, and other industries that are totally unrelated. Okay, so here we go, and I'm going to do some commentary as I go through these. Otherwise, it would just be a long list and most people would fall asleep. But understand that each one of these topics is groundbreaking in terms of understanding how the universe works, etc. Okay, so initially, things you're already very familiar with, the Planet X comets and Earth changes, that is a mouthful. That's a whole series of major topics in itself. Then the pole shifts from external celestial sources. This is so important because it is the basis of the history of man. These are events in history that shaped the human race and completely unrecognized in standard modern, any kind of teachings that are in the modern world, including the churches, which supposedly harbor the Bible and talk about the Bible, etc., but just completely ignore these ancient events, which were monumental. And then the solar system celestial mechanical mechanisms. So these are simply the workings of the solar system, the comet capture, etc., the formation of planets. And when that happens, many times very violent events in the solar system. And when they affect Earth, the human race really comes out of it with legends and myths, because they really don't know what happened. And even, like, take if something major happened today. Today's human race, and just understand it would be somewhat random who survived, etc., the human race today is no more savvy about the workings of the solar system than they were in the times of Noah or Moses when these major events were happening. And, the fairy tale science is being put out there. People just don't have any idea. So literally, if something happened today and they say that, oh, today man is more advanced than any time in history. No, man is not advanced. Man is a stumbling, bumbling group of people who use credit cards and, go to the bathroom twice a day. That's the best thing you can say about the human race. I'm sorry, but it's really true. And so in general, the human race is just ignorant about if major celestial events happen. And even though you go to the church every week, and you pray, churches have become what I call prayer repeaters. You repeat a prayer so many times and you feel like you're holy or something, but they don't teach them anything. They don't teach any reality about what happened in the past and events that can happen in the future and how to live an independent lifetime. Okay, so published papers, the Continuing Galactic Formation, that's a peer-reviewed published paper from when I was in Cornell, and then the explanation of galactic arm light curves. Now, that's kind of a mouthful for some of you, but the data taken with spectrometers of galactic arms shows a certain velocity, the stars with a certain velocity around the nucleus. And this has been known about for decades, you know, back to the actual 1950s was when some of this work first came out. And never have they ever made real attempts at understanding this. So what do? They create dark matter, dark energy, then things that just are nonsensical. And then all of this other bizarre so-called physics comes out of it, which doesn't make any sense at all. And then the Saturn sweeper moons. Now, Saturn is such an important star. It's not a planet. It's a little star. And that paper that I wrote, it's peer-reviewed, published in peer-reviewed astrophysics journal called The Moon and the Planets at the time. Now that name has changed. I think it's just called the name has changed anyway from that period of time, but it was called The Moon and the Planets. But such an important paper because Saturn is a little star. It's a little solar system. It has a proton wind. It has its own capacitor. And all of the things that you see relative to comets and sunward spikes and the tail of comets, etc., all of those things you see, the discharges to the central star with moons, the moon Dione of Saturn, discharging just like the moon Io of Jupiter is discharging to the planet. We call it a planet, the central star. Jupiter is a little star also. But that paper is short, but it's so important because it lays the groundwork for everything electrical in the solar system. Now, this list is going to go on and on. So I'm going to, like I say, try to break this up a little bit. Okay, the next topic, the many Planet X objects. You know, so you have all of these yahoos running around out there talking about Planet X. No, there's a lot of them. And at the time, well, let's go back 10 years, there were over 140 confirmed Planet X types of objects out there. These are big. These are planetary-sized objects, not little teeny comets. And so there are many. Now there are thousands of them, literally. And so the study of that, and this goes back long before the term Planet X was popularized, but literally Planet X simply means a planetary object that has been discovered but does not have a name attached to it first. And these names are given by an international group of astronomers. And then next, Surviving Planet X Passage, a really, really important little book, tells you how to build a calendar with a pile of rocks. Talks about ancient stone circles, archaeology, and then it gives drawings on how pole shifts actually work. Okay, the next topic, the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, but in there, rediscovering and advancing the work of Tesla. Tesla was one of the most creative scientists. When Albert Einstein was asked, what does it feel like to be the greatest scientist in the world? Albert Einstein said, go ask Tesla. They were compatriots. They were at work at the same time. They actually lived in the same part of the world at the time. Einstein was at Princeton, and Tesla lived in New York City. Although Tesla, of course, had research stations out at Colorado Springs, etc. But what I did is I went through the work of Tesla, and I rediscovered what he was doing. And the biggest thing he was doing was tapping into atmospheric electricity at the Wardenclyffe Tower, and then also discovering how he was going to distribute it. And the modern story that is pawned off on the public, of course, disinformation, is that he was going to use the Wardenclyffe Tower to transmit energy. Totally false. Tesla was transmitting the energy in the ground. And he did this at the Colorado Springs facility, and that's what he was doing at the Wardenclyffe Tower. And so, anyway, rediscovering Tesla's work and discovering where the electrical source was that he was tapping into. That's something Tesla did not know about. He didn't know where the vertical electric field came from. He didn't know about the solar wind. Remember, he died in the middle of World War II. So this is long, long before the space race, before space data was back, before understanding the Van Allen belts, or even understanding about electric charges in space. You know, there were some people that had a hint at this, but they had no data. They had no information with which to, they could see, like Langmuir or Hans Albin, who did some work, but also very incorrect when you look by modern standards. It's not that he was stupid. He just didn't have data. He didn't have information to go by, even though Alvin did live into the modern space era. He never did fully understand the non-uniform electric field around the sun. And so when you understand that, that is what powers the entire solar system. That's what powered Tesla's Wardenclyffe Tower and Colorado Springs Towers, etc. So what I did is I discovered the electrical processes, the 17 electrical local electrical batteries around Earth, and then developed propulsion systems. So I rediscovered Tesla's work, I advanced it, understood where the electric fields were coming from, and then went back to Atlantis to understand what they were doing, connected the two, and then brought in the Colbran, which was a discussion of ancient large comets and a lot of other things. But the Colbran begins by talking about the ancient large comets. And there it solidifies exactly what was going on back then. Not just the Noah event, not just the Noah's flood event, not just the Moses event, and those are discussed in the Colbran. And you have to understand what it's talking about to put those into perspective. Okay, 1997, the in situ survey of Chichen Itza and the old North Pole alignment, something people are actually working on today. But in the mid-90s, I was down in Central South America, in Mexico, surveying on the ground with a transit, surveying those cities and going out into the jungle and finding the old survey posts that are literally there from the Maya era, and then discovering the western entry into the city. It was an arch, which I discovered out once again away from the city, and that's where the troops would come in after a war, because the Mayas were very warlike. But understanding the alignment of these cities, and then triangulating to find the old North Pole, which was in Hudson's Bay. And the way I would put that in the Lannis to Tesla, the Colbran Connection book, was in Hudson's Bay, but what I said was in Ontario, north of the state of Michigan, which is Hudson's Bay. Okay, so also the in situ survey of Uxmal, Tulum, and the old North Pole alignment, the same issue, surveying these cities on the ground with equipment. Okay, the solar system, sun, earth connection, space, weather. Now, this is a field that literally I developed completely. Worked with the Russian scientists in the University of Novosibirsk, Alexei Dmitriev, and you can see those exchanges, just a sample of them, in the back of my book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. You can see those exchanges, but to understand how solar system weather really works, what is it powered with? It's not powered by solar light, because you have planets like Uranus and Neptune, which have tremendous wind. But when you look back at the sun from those planets, the sun is going to look just like a little bit bigger than average star. It's not producing any kind of, I mean, it would be like a dim flashlight in a London fog. It just wouldn't be there. It's not a contributing factor. So to imagine that somehow the sun is producing all of this weather activity on Jupiter and Saturn and these other outer planets, And then to see snow raining in from outside the atmosphere on the planet Pluto and Charon, where these are comets. These are actually comets out there, and there's no sunlight there. I mean, they are really far from the sun. The sun there looks just like another star. It's not even a big dot in the sky. It's just another star. That's how far away those planets are. And then you see these comets developing in other solar systems. So it relates it to other nearby stars where you see this development of comets. And it explains where the Kuiper Belt objects come from. Why are there thousands of planets outside of the nine original planets, which includes Pluto? Why are there all of a sudden thousands of planets out there? What's going on? How are they forming? How did they get there? And so my work shows exactly how that works and shows photographs of other star systems that that show the exact same thing. You can see the comets forming out in those outer regions around other stars. Okay, so that is just an immense topic in its own. Next, the induced electric dipole redshift. In other words, the real reason why our universe is not expanding. This baloney about the Big Bang and the Hubble expansion of the universe, just fairy tale science, never was true in the first place. And there are groups that I belong to, research groups with supposedly top-level scientists around the world, and these people are just off in la-la land with trying to imagine zero points and the whole universe reflected into some kind of unity or zero point where everything is in a point with no dimensions, just absurdities. But the reality is that no matter how big a telescope we build, we never ever see to the real edge of the universe, because every time we build a bigger telescope, we see farther, we see more galaxies, etc. And so, you know, that we're limited. It's like the people who used to live in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, that they thought that the firmament was held up by the mountains, that there was just this big dome over the earth and that the sun and the moon and the stars just rotated over on this firmament. That's what they thought. And then one day some guy climbed up over the mountain. He goes, hey, there's land over there too. And the firmament is not held up by these mountains. And the people are like, well, no, we believe that the firmament is right there. So the people keep believing something that's patently false, because that's their belief system. But the induced electric dipole redshift is the concept that's laboratory provable, that shows that the redshift given off by galaxies and quasars, etc., has nothing to do with them moving away from us, but it has to do with internal properties of the star and then the proton wind and the non-uniform electric field. So it's another electromagnetic effect. And this is something, here again, Einstein was looking for this. He was very interested in Velikovsky's work because Velikovsky talked about electricity in outer space, and there was something going on out there. And they lived together in near neighbors in Princeton. And Einstein was very, very interested in Velikovsky's work for the simple reason that Einstein was looking for an electromagnetic component to outer space. And of course, Einstein died in, 1954, long before the space programs got going, long before there was any understanding of solar wind or things like that. There were some rudimentary ideas. But he just didn't have the information. And he was literally looking for this because general relativity, Einstein was convinced that general relativity was false, this idea that there was a redshift due to extreme gravity and the bending of space. It didn't add up, and he knew it. And so he was looking for something else. When I was at Cornell, I talked to one of Einstein's good friends, Hans Bethe. I had many conversations with Hans and discussed the sun and the real working of the sun. And of course, this work I had when I was at Cornell, and I was That's why Hans Bethe encouraged me to publish in these European journals where my paper started to get published, and eventually got blackballed by the clowns at Cornell, who didn't like competing information. But this is such an important, this is a cosmologically, and then also down to the subatomic world, because one thing that was never and still has never been identified in subatomic physics, in the nuclear physics, in fact, is why X-rays, when they pass near the nucleus of a, especially the large atoms, like the uranium, etc., when an X-ray passes by them, it splits into pair production. What's causing that? And it turns out to be the same property of light. The electron positron pair are in all the photons. And so with the high energy photons, you have them very close together. And so when they get into that high non-uniform field around large atoms, that is within the electrons, inside the electron shells, and being influenced by the non-uniform electric field, which is extremely high around atomic nuclei, that pulls the photon apart and you have pair production. And so it's a conservation of charge principle also, something that does not exist in physics. When they recombine, when those recombine, the energy turns into light and X-ray or gamma ray, whatever it is, and the charges are still contained in there. They don't go away, they don't disappear, they don't neutralize. They are contained in there, and they can separate in a non-uniform electric field. And that's the same cause of the induced electric dipole redshift when these photons are leaving a quasar or galactic nucleus or star, like our own star produces a redshift. Over astronomical distances, this very slight force causes a redshift, and it's always a redshift. It's never a blue shift. It's always a loss of energy because the induced electric dipole force is always attractive. So at any rate, very important topics, and once again, within these topics are, I've talked about this, Nobel Prize winning accomplishments. Okay, on to the plasma discharge comet model. Need I say more? This is so fundamentally important because all the planets, all the moons, all the asteroids, and even little dust particles follow the principles of the plasma discharge comet model. And also there are you might call them, understanding of how the solar system works and how it can be used and manipulated by man, etc. So very, very important work there, and a core issue, but not the not just about comets, because, for example, our own sun is acting as a comet in the intergalactic wind. So our sun is acting as a comet. Where does it get the hydrogen from that keeps nourishing the fusion fire on the sun? The plasma discharge comet model explains that. Where do the electric currents come from that go down the galactic arm, which allow the propulsion systems to work for interplanetary travel? Once again, the plasma discharge comet model working on a galactic scale. So absolutely fundamentally important to understand this. Okay, here's one that is huge, that solar systems are formed by capture, that these objects come in from afar. Some of them are associated with the solar system. They might have a 1,000-year orbit, or like Hale-Bopp, a 4,250-year orbit that changes to a 2,600-year orbit on one passage of the sun. It'll be back in another 2,500 years. And then another chance at being captured into the solar system, etc. And then thousands of these objects have potential to become planets. And once they're captured into the inner solar system, they're probably going to eventually encounter the planets until they become a planet themselves, just like Venus is a recent member of our solar system. So it solves that problem that the mainstream astronomers never could figure out, and that is, how did Venus, in Belikovsky's story of Venus becoming a planet, how did it get to where it is? Because it would have to pass by Mars and Earth, Well, it did. And it had very violent interactions when it did. It interacted with Earth on two occasions. We know this from the ancient texts. And the second one was much more devastating than the first one. And so that's where Venus started orbiting in slowly. The tail drag is a very important concept here. And the utilization of the work by TJJC and the secular action of the resisting medium, as it is called by TJJC. And once again, that's a book that I found in the stacks at Cornell, a book that's totally ignored in modern science because they never imagined there was a resisting medium. Well, what I discovered was, yeah, the resisting medium is very sparse, but with the comet discharge pulls that material in large quantities, and that is the cause of the orbital reduction and the circularization of orbits. Very important how solar systems form by capture. Over 27 of the moons of Saturn are known to have been captured. And so then they try and say, oh, but the other ones were just there from the original formation of the solar system. So once again, the standard science that somehow the solar system formed all at one time 4.5 billion years ago is just fairy tale science. It's just something that they pulled out of a hat and everybody repeats. And as long as they keep repeating it, they keep getting a paycheck. And as long as they keep getting a paycheck, nobody's going to upset the apple cart. Okay, the solar capacitor. This is what makes it all happen. So I'll just read the next few. Solar capacitor, the surface fusion of the sun and ball lightning, controlled fusion. Wow. And all of these together, understanding that the fusion of the sun is not in the core, but up in the atmosphere. And that atmosphere does not have enough hydrogen and deuterium to burn for very long, so it has to be constantly supplied. And so the sun is literally acting as a comet, and this hydrogen is constantly being supplied, just like a comet nucleus, where the hydrogen is coming in and it's burning, and that's variable. It can change over time. So sometimes the sun is hotter, sometimes it's cooler, and on a minute-to-minute basis, the solar output is changing. But the other thing here is that the solar light that is given in the microwave, in the infrared, the visible, the UV, the X-ray, and in also cosmic rays, which are relativistic protons, all of this energy is electrical. And the solar light that reaches Earth's surface has literally almost nothing to do, very, very little to do with our weather. Getting back to that point, but all of the weather in the solar system, all of the comets, everything in the solar system is powered by this electrical battery, which is created by a non-uniform current of protons in the solar wind. This is so fundamental to how everything works, and once again, completely ignored by science. Science cannot tell you, modern science cannot tell you why there's a sea of relativistic electrons around the sun. It's called the solar corona. You can see it. You can see it if they're during a solar eclipse with the moon directly between Earth and the sun. You can see the corona out there, and it's visible, but primarily made up of relativistic electrons. Well, what keeps an electron moving at the speed of light orbiting around the sun? It's certainly not gravity. They don't have an answer. So they just make up more fairy tale science and leave it as one of those unsolved problems. But understanding, and then the Russians proved this by a very interesting experiment using X-ray detectors. I talk about that in the weather book. Okay, now what I'm going to do here is pick up the pace a little bit, because if not, I will not fit this all in within this one show. So I'm going to pick up the pace. The electrical effects of planetary physics and weather. Okay, then the proof of recent oceans on Mars. Very, very important, because Mars is a planet that historically the ancients talked about Mars being a water planet. Mars was a blue planet. And when Venus, the comet, came by, it relieved Mars of its oceans and atmosphere. And you can see this all over Mars. And, of course, NASA comes along and says, well, yeah, it had oceans, but it was 2.5 billion years ago. Once again, fairy tale science. It's like the 4.5 billion year old solar system that they keep repeating, like a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. It simply doesn't have any basis in fact. It's just a number that is way out there that nobody could prove nor disprove. But the actual reality is, I have on my Picture of the Day subpage on my webpage, and also the centerpiece of my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, I have the complete photograph set of the surface of Mars. And you can see the water, erosion, etc. And I have a lot of pictures, like I say, on the Picture of the Day subpage that show Mars' surface features as very recent, because Mars has these tremendous wind storms that just the 300-mile-an-hour wind storms with dust blowing. They would erode anything 2.5 billion years ago. There would be nothing left. So, of course, NASA has to create a lie to cover its tracks. Okay, so reading onwards here. I talked a number of weeks ago about my videos, the remastered videos that were remastered from VHS tapes of lectures over my history. And, of course, these are just a selected few, but also offering a paper trail of my work and my presentation of my work going back decades. Very important to establish that I'm the one that developed this, not the clowns that you see jumping up and down on the internet today, people with no scientific background. So creating a paper trail is very important. Then I have a DVD, University Level Astronomy, Astrophysics, Space Science course on my webpage. Very important because it really goes into, for example, the structure of galaxies and the symmetry of galaxies. Things that are very important in understanding the galaxies, which are the basis for all of the star systems, etc., etc. Then included in that set of DVDs, etc., is an independent DVD that I sell on my webpage, What the Japanese Want to Know About Planet X. It was an interview conducted by the Japanese that aired on primetime Japanese television. I've talked about that before, so just briefly mentioning it. I've been a number of times on Russian television, interview on primary primetime television also. Space weather and U.S. space program, that I understood a lot about the Russian space program because I worked with Russian scientists who were integrally involved in the Russian space program. And a lot of that took place out in central Russia. And, of course, they were very interested in the Tunguska event, understanding that it was an electrical event, not an asteroid colliding into Earth. And, of course, at the University of Novosibirsk in Russia, the development of the control of hurricanes with laser satellites, huge, important phenomenon that is now fundamental and has been weaponized by the Western military, the United States primarily, in using these technologies to attack the public and to control crops, to other types of control of the weather. Ongoing investigations of atmospheric electrical phenomena, and that's something that just continues. Then, very interesting, a collaboration with the psychology department at the University of Novosibirsk in Russia, dealing with the basis of planetary positions and astrological effects on unborn and newborn babies. That was something that came out of the work with the physicists there. Okay, I have on my webpage 11 mega-Earth projects. These are projects that can change the future of the Earth, one of them being the very first one, I believe, is the draining of the lake at Yellowstone so that there's no major eruption there. Because the three major eruptions, the pyroclastic type of eruptions on from the Yellowstone caldera, were when it had a large volume of water. And what happens is when there's a large earthquake, that water drops down, hits the magma, and that's where the explosion comes from. And so also understanding that volcanic eruptions have to do with water. Basically, you have a big steam engine in the ground where the water drops down, hits that magma, and explodes and sends, you know, half a mountain up into the stratosphere. And modern geology does not understand this fundamental principle. They think that it comes from gases that come up from the ground. How ridiculous. It's just absolutely absurd. Water rights. Who owns water? And my book, Water, that's the title of the book, is Water. So this is an extremely important topic that a lot of people just simply don't know about, the real issues with water. And then, of course, the water filter product line, basically understanding the issues with filtration of water. First of all, what's in the water? How do you get that out of the water? And how do you create a commercial product that then you can mass produce and sell to the public? So not just understanding the water and the water issues and who controls water, but giving a solution that the public can purchase at a relatively reasonable price. And, of course, the wing generator. I talked about that a couple weeks ago. And then the patents on the wing generator. So very important not only to develop a product, but have it patented. And all of the issues that go with having patents on a marketable product for the energy industry. Electromagnetic propulsion systems and designs, electric highways to the stars, and this being presented at closed military meetings, etc., and on various different designs, and understanding also how to mitigate radiation in outer space as part of that. Things that I've not talked about in public or even in private meetings, some of these I keep under my hat, so to speak, because I think it's important for man to develop as a species before they go running off to Mars or into outer space. And taking the human race into space has a lot of responsibility along with it. And I don't think the human race in any way, shape, or form, especially people who commercialize it and want to own it, people who would overthrow the governments of foreign countries simply to get raw materials like lithium in Bolivia, very good example of where private companies and private individuals have gone in to overthrow the government to procure rights to those natural resources. So that's why I'm not letting out my other propulsion system and how to control, mitigate radiation in outer space, etc. Okay, so then a long history of being invited to secure locations like Los Alamos National Laboratories and invited military talks in front of closed groups, Aerospace America Air Show, just some examples of places where I've been invited to speak on these topics, electromagnetic propulsion systems, electric nature of the solar system, of the universe, etc., and the electrical current sources in the galactic arms, very important. I have a private space program, which is something all by itself. Some of that is public. You can see that on my webpage, the JMCC Hotel Space Hotel Launch System, a very innovative twist because other people have products, space launch products, where they go from the runway. Of course, the Burt Rutan Spaceship One and Richard Branson companies now advancing those technologies to commercialize space tourism. But the twist that I have is very different. It's something very innovative and something that will be developed with time. The recalendar sun-star clock to rebuild a calendar after the pole shift, something that literally nobody has thought of, let alone done before, and then to build a clock and a calendar based on the sun and the stars that you can buy for under $50, and a very good teaching tool for understanding the calendar. It works any place in the north or southern hemisphere, and most ancient mariners would have loved to have had one of these in their ship's map cabinet. But that's something, it's very unique, and it has all of the properties of the Earth's orbit, so that someday at 1,000 years, 10,000 years from now, when somebody discovers one of these, they can put together our civilization. If there's been a pole shift, they will know exactly what our current orbit is relative to our own calendar, our own Julian calendar. Okay, ancient archaeology. And so this includes Mayan runes, a survey of ancient runes, understanding the destruction of ancient runes, etc. The physics of ancient celestial disasters is something. I have a 2-CD set with interviews by very famous people like Warner Sizemore, the private secretary of Emmanuel Velikovsky. It's people that you would probably never have an inside view of if it were not for my work and my being attuned to detail, knowing that Warner was aging and he finally did pass away. But Warner Sizemore, a very good friend, private secretary of Emmanuel Velikovsky, and I have a number of private interviews with him on this 2D, it's a 2-CD set, 18 hours of MP3 lectures that I gave. It's available on my webpage, and the lectures dealing with Planet X and ancient celestial disasters. Okay, so in this surveying of ancient ruins, now this is something that, remember, when I was young, I lived in Mexico. I lived in Mexico City. It was my first job out of college. And my job was teaching, and what I also did, I had a very thriving business tutoring the high school students of the very, very wealthy people in Mexico City. So I'd go up to their house and be let in by the gate, the guards. I'd go in and tutor the students and, you know, got to know the people who lived there. And basically, Mexico City has some of the very richest people in the world. And there's a lot of wealth there, in spite of the fact that it's a third world country with a lot of poverty out in the countryside. But that set up my understanding of Mexico, because I traveled all over Mexico. I traveled everywhere. I had a brand new Econoline window van, a Ford, and it was brand new when I went to Mexico. So I was able to travel and on places where most people would never get to. So I had a good first-hand understanding of Mexico. So when I went back on multiple occasions to go survey, etc., I knew where to go, I knew what equipment to take, I knew how to get transportation, I knew how to move in Mexico, and all the things that I had to do to accomplish my archaeological goals, not the least of which was surveying the ruins. And how do you do that and get into these ruin sites without any tourist when there are no tourists there, etc. So the Mayan Venus calendar is something also that I understand. There is so much misunderstanding about the Mayan calendar. It relates to the pre-Venus calendar of the Mayans. And so that's why it has a different counting, etc., of the situation in the solar system. It does not go back 4,000 years. It goes back much less than that. And so the Mayans had to recalendar their clock, and that was one of the big issues that Velikovsky came upon when he was studying calendars. Velikovsky was not studying astronomy or looking for anything to do with comets. He was looking for specific events, worldwide events, where they could put a zero line in the world of archaeology, and discovered the Venus event, with Mars, the two different Venus events with Earth, and then this was central to the Mayan calendar. So once again, the physics of ancient celestial disasters. So how do you apply my physics principles that I understand about the solar system to ancient celestial disasters? The Noah event, the Moses event, the Mayans, the Popol Vuh, Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky. When I was young, I was in Mexico, and I talked about this, going out into the jungle and walking out into a Lacandon village down in Quintana Roo, and standing in a little hut where a lady has this little kind of like a little store set up for the local people where they would trade chickens and eggs and other local commodities. And so here I am, and she's about 4 feet tall and like a little bird. And I'm this giant, and I'm welcome into their city because the men took me into one of the huts, and they were drinking their homemade, a liquor they made from cactus. And so anyway, the goal was on a new bottle to drink the worm that would float down in the bottle. So you had to tip the bottle up and drink until the worm went in your mouth and you ate the worm. And the worm, of course, was preserved because it was in the alcohol, a very high content alcohol. And when I did that, they cheered like I just won the Super Bowl, and I was welcomed into their village. So then I end up into this woman's little shop, like a little thatched roof hut with a little counter there, and she's behind the counter. Like I say, she's about 4 feet tall, Lacandon. And above her head is a Quetzal bird. And it's like late in the afternoon when I'm there. And this Quetzal bird opens his wings and flies directly over my head. Something that I've always said, that this, somebody was directing me to be in these places at these set times, because then I understood that the Quetzal bird represented was a bird of paradise with long flowing tail, and it looked like the coloration pattern on the bottom of the wings and of the bird were of a large comet. And I did not put all of this together till literally a decade later or more when I was at Cornell. But understanding Quetzalcoatl and the plumed serpent god of the night sky was a comet. And so all of these things being put together, ancient archaeology. Then the Nazca Lines, a discovery that I made in 2015, that the Nazca Lines are a fractal antenna array. And so I'll just mention that briefly. Aerial photography, I have a disc on my webpage dealing with aerial photography, high altitude aerial photography of the entire American Southwest. Just mention that briefly. And the truth about Comet Hale-Bopp, the Harrington expedition, the Harrington discovery that Hale-Bopp's nucleus was the Planet X object that he discovered in 1991, and that whole topic, which was totally misrepresented by the CIA-controlled NASA. I'm going to have to speed up here. The mathematical solutions, the prime number solutions, calculate primes, the generator function, and then the more advanced work on prime numbers, dealing with some of the solutions of prime numbers. And I'll just briefly mention that. Breaking RSA codes for fun and profit, number theory, then the development of a Windows Android operating system to take back your phone. That's something that unfortunately never got funded properly. Water filtration products, the political corruption and commentary, which I've done over the years, and also the understanding of who these corrupt individuals are in their relation to the World Bank. States' rights, the United Nation and the fake federal government, living free, or free living, I should say, and the nuclear disaster. I spent a lot of time talking about Fukushima because my advanced physics degree is in nuclear and solid-state physics, and the EPA shutting down nuclear radiation detectors nationwide to cover up the radiation that was coming into the United States from Fukushima. Now it's public. The uranium, the cesium, the strontium, all in the water tables of the United States. And, of course, the water filter products that I have that will remove these. Talking about chemtrails long before the people that you hear today talking about chemtrails and weather manipulation. I was on radio shows. Alex Merklinger, Cliff High was with me on some of those shows. He's still around today and doing very good work exposing these devastating effects that are being basically placed on top of the human race. The discovery and theory of hurricane cyclonic storms driven by electrical currents from the ionosphere, and then climate and weather engineering using laser satellites. Ecuador earthquakes created from rods from God, nuclear weapons. This was an Obama era set of devastations in Ecuador because they were housing a political, international political asylum of somebody who had exposed the Obama administration for war crimes. My paid cast and education program, which is available to the public, 4 years, a lecture every week dealing with all kinds of science topics, including a special section on the radiation and you, Tesla's mind, environmental toxins, the world before the great flood, cybersecurity, secret societies, election fraud, mathematical analysis, and of course the 20-session discussion on Carl Sagan's Cosmos series, where I rip it apart and bring it back into a put it into perspective piece by piece. Okay, well, I'm going to stop there because there's actually a lot more. It took this entire show to discuss all of these different aspects of my work. I don't know anybody that's done this much, or even groups of people, and certainly not our illustrious national space agencies, etc. So I just wanted to point out the scope of my work, and when I'm on radio shows, the people that interview me actually point this out, and because they've studied my work, they've learned a lot from it, and also I'm probably a person that's relatively humble, live a very simple life, and just trying to do my part in helping this world using the talents that God gave me. And also encouraging the youth today to study, to get away from the phones and the televisions and the modern conveniences and flick games, etc., and start studying physics. So we have a new round of good physicists coming up. Once again, visit my webpages, jmccwaterfilters.com, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.